Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and it's the 24th of September, 2014. The reason I go through that little announcement rigmarole is because I post these talks, and a link gets posted to them on the San Rafael Meditation Group Facebook page, which is a good place to get information. Also, if you don't yet receive emails from me about the sitting group, and you want to, there's an email sign-up list over there as well. I'll never share your email address with anyone, and you can always unsubscribe. But also, I post these talks on my website, so if you're interested, you can go back and check them out. So this talk is about object relations and the Dharma. And for those of you who are therapists in the room, who know some of the lingo here, you're probably wondering, what the? But anyway, so let me explain what I mean. So a long time ago, the Buddha basically made some observations, and he had some suggestions based on his observations. And he also was very clear that you should take nothing on faith alone, but really see for yourself, you know, what led to happiness and what led to suffering. So he observed that when people get attached to experience of various kinds, when they get attached to what's pleasant or attached to fighting what's unpleasant, or attached to moving on quickly from what's neutral to find something better, right? When they do that, they tend to create suffering and harm for themselves and other people. And he recommended that people gradually cultivate a relationship to experience which is increasingly unattached. He developed the middle way in which he was not trying to shut down experience or go to war with experience. That was the path of the Jains, more or less, of his time. He said, no, that won't lead to full awakening. The issue is not experience per se, experience qua experience, but rather our relationship to it. Okay? So when he talked about non-attachment to experience, he was talking about two kinds of non-attachment. Non-attachment to specific experiences, like pleasure or pain. And he was also talking about non-attachment to experience altogether, to experience as experience unfolding. So he developed a variety of practices and suggestions for people to help them progressively become less attached, while simultaneously living in the world in an engaged way, as monastics who are living in the world in very real ways, or the great bulk of people living in the world as householders, and yet increasingly free, and also increasingly free in relationship to their experience. So to help us do that, he made various observations about particular experiences and experience altogether, in which he was pointing out various aspects of experience, for example, the part of experience that's sort of the bare perception of reality, or the part of experience that's what he called the feeling tone, or in modern psychology we would call it the hedonic tone of experience being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Right? He also pointed out other aspects of experience. Is there tranquility, or is there disturbance? Is there mindfulness, or is there forgetfulness? Is there compassion, or is there ill will? And so many, many people have practiced with these distinctions he was drawing about different aspects of experience and different observations he made about the causal relationships between these various parts of our experience. What leads to happiness and freedom, and what leads to suffering and contraction? Since the Buddha taught, 2,500 years have passed, you've probably noticed, and many things have been discerned about experience, both parts of experience and also experience altogether, including especially recently in psychology, roughly the last 100, 150 or so years. And one of the major developments, both theoretical and practical, in psychology has been about how our childhood experiences shape us in ways that linger on into adulthood. And it's useful, I find, in practice to have some basic understanding of some of these teachings about the nature of our experience from developmental psychology or clinical psychology, because we can become more mindful of of different aspects of our experience and more skillful in our relationship to them. It's not that we're getting sucked into, you know, endless psychoanalyzing on the zafu, right, on the cushion, but we're using this information, much as the Buddha offered his own pointing out instructions about different aspects of experience, to become more aware of our experience, more self-aware, and more skillful in how we deal with it. So that's my introduction into this chunk of material I want to talk about tonight. And so, how many of you are therapists how many of you have ever heard of the term object relations? Not very many. That's okay, good. Anyway, beginner's mind, Zen mind, as they say. So let me introduce this basic idea. So, child is born, you are born, right? And you can just see the thought balloon over your head as a newborn infant. What the? All right? Okay? Without words, of course. And so all this stuff is happening, and you know, your brain is trying to make sense of it. And fairly quickly, the structure of knowledge, especially immediate knowledge of the world of sensation of the body and these strange, blurry figures moving around who make you feel better when they, you know, give you something to eat, for example. The structure of your emerging knowledge about the world is in a fundamental, if you will, self-object paradigm of one kind or another. Object is just a technical term here. It's not used as a physical thingamajigger unless it is. Other people would be an object. A part of a person, such as a face or a frown or a breast, could be an object. Groups of people, men, women, authority figures, siblings, could be objects as well. Okay? In other words, it's self and other. Self and other being the structure of the knowing. By self, I don't mean some kind of elaborate sense of me, myself, and I. It's sort of like this, you know, streaming of experience that's linked to this body and this perspective and everything else. So far? Okay. Then a very interesting thing happens. The infant, and then the toddler, the preschooler, the elementary school kid, and on up to today, internalizes this representation of reality, self and other, self and object, and it becomes internalized. So it's kind of like me and the internal critic. Me and this thing I do, eating sweets that's soothing and calming when I'm upset, when me is upset. You see right there again? Or me and this nurturing, encouraging, internalized figure who reassures me that I'm not actually a bad person just because I made a little mistake at work. Right? Self and other, self and object. Do you see the basic structure of that? And so I'm saying all this not to teach some kind of abstract, you know, grad school class in developmental psychology or some aspect of psychodynamic theory, which is where object relations arose, kind of the intersection of developmental psychology and psychoanalysis. But rather, I'm trying to open up a territory for greater self-awareness and greater non-attachment to experience and greater wisdom in our relationship with experience. So I'm inviting you in to kind of looking at yourself and how do you, what's the habit or the tendency in terms of representing knowledge about the world or yourself? I don't mean knowledge abstractly. I mean more like the tacit presumptions or assumptions that are rolling through. So I want to give some examples now. So calling on myself here. So there I am at the break, you know, thinking to myself, how am I going to structure this talk on object relations? And then I thought of this introduction into it that I've done with you. And I could observe arising fairly rapidly within, you know, around 3/4 of a second, because you can see this stuff, right? Especially after you've been meditating for a while. Arising this kind of anticipated response from the internalized audience, oh, they'll like that. They'll think that's really smart. Yeah, how groovy, the Buddha about experience. Yeah, like that. So fast. We have this internalized, like tacit, implicit other, implicit object. Right? Or alternately, you know, there in me, not so much tonight, but at other times, there would be like a sort of little mini reverie about, yeah, you know, maybe I should send the email like that, right? And then they'll get it, and then internalize was like, they won't like it. They'll get mad. I'll look like a fool. Right? Bad pain. Don't do that. So you see the nature of that? The thing is, a lot of those object relations are just the legacy of early childhood experiences, and in a very real sense, they're kind of delusional. And they're the background murmuring, much of them, and they also happen very quickly. And they kind of condition or shape our expectations, our presumption as to whether it would be good or bad to go left or right, to do this or do that in a relationship. And if we're not aware of them, they catch us and they hijack us. So I'm going to name some two major patterns of relationship to these objects, and then I want to talk about kind of a bigger picture point, and then open it up and see what you think. Okay, so far? Is this kind of, okay, good. So, one classic pattern is where the object, particularly the other person, you know, basically as we evolved, it's argued that certainly over the last million years, the primary adaptation of the human species, which was still evolving very intensively over just the last million years or so, was not so much things like the development of an opposable thumb, right? Or the ability to walk upright, or the ability to, you know, make tools. But rather, the primary adaptation is presumed of that have been the defining characteristics of the human species, certainly in the last million years or so, is adaptation to group living, adaptation to other people, to cooperative planning, to language, to romance, to teamwork, to politics, to gossip, to alliances, to who's in and who's out. In other words, to junior high altogether. Right? Right? That's our primary adaptation. And so in that context, you know, the most stimulating object in the world is another person's face, right? And the most important information to track, the most important objects are other people. And the most consequential internalized objects are internalized others or aspects of others, right? The aspect, let's say, of my father who is determined and conscientious and keeps on going. Or the aspect of my father, let's say, who under pressure can get kind of pissy and cranky. Right? Those are both alive in the mind. Right? So it can be a part of a person too. Okay? So in that context then, one common structure in our object relations is one in which we still really long for what are called healthy narcissistic supplies. We still very much long for attunement, joining, empathic resonance, prizing, valuing, making us special. And also in this pattern, a person is particularly sensitive to devaluation, the opposite of what is longed for. Being devalued, being put down, criticized, scorned, you are not worthy, right? So, and by the way, these paradigms, these object relations tend to be particularly activated in intense relationships that have some kind of family quality to them, like a romantic relationship, a couple, or maybe a situation at work or in others where there are authority figures who are very significant. And I want to distinguish between a kind of, I'm going to use a deliberate word here, a kind of neurotic relationship to those longings and an ordinary healthy relationship in which, of course, we want to experience empathic resonance, you know, that others get us and receive us and are emotionally available to us, and that we actually matter to them in some appropriate way. That's okay. That's okay to seek. It's also okay to seek if, honestly, you're like me, and that wholesome wish, as wholesome as the wish to inhale the next breath, really, for social beings like us, is, if you're like me, intertwined with some neurotic material. The one doesn't disqualify the other, right? And some of the art is to sort of keep teasing them apart and to be brave enough and open enough to kind of reveal yourself and then discover yourself in the process of relating to others. Okay, so that's kind of a classic object relations dynamic. The longing for narcissistic supplies and a vulnerability to feeling narcissistically devalued. Okay? A second common paradigm is one in which there is a seeking of an optimal distance, in which getting really, really close is experienced as scary based on a personal history in which getting really, really close was painful, or you could see that it was painful for others. It felt invasive or overwhelming or abusive or weird or otherwise problematic, or as if you were way too responsible for the depression of your mother, let's say. While at the same time, in this form of object relations, there's also a discomfort with complete autonomy, full self-expression, just being authentically out there. Because when that happened, like the Japanese proverb says, the nail that stands out gets hammered down. So a person then seeks a kind of what's called orbiting relationship, where with regard to significant others or others in one's own mind, or aspects of others in one's own mind, because you can see this self-object dynamic can happen quite publicly, and usually happens mainly quite internally, right? There's a sense of never wanting to get too close to the object, nor too independent and free. So there's a kind of orbiting, it's sometimes called. You see that kind of dynamic? Both can be present for me in my own journey. In my mid-20s, when I came upon this stuff about narcissistic longings and so on, it was devastatingly accurate. It really described a lot about my own childhood and what was problematic about it and where I was still pretty neurotic, you know, at the time. You can judge for yourself how neurotic I still am. But anyway, and like, wow, that was a big wake-up call for me, the sort of under the narcissistic heading. And it was a real process, and actually for me a lot, to try to filter out wheat from chaff, to try to get a grip on my more neurotic, you know, clingings and cravings and attachments and reactivities, while also, paradoxically, by really feeding the healthy longings for narcissistic supplies and filling that hole in my own heart that I've talked about, that really helped me become less neurotic about this. See that important point I'm making there? Okay. Then, somewhat early in my training, I was probably early 40s, I came across the second object relations, sometimes called schizoidal. That's just a technical term, okay? And these are seen as normal, very normal ways of being. They can be very pathological, very bizarrely extreme. I'm speaking really of the normal process that happens here. So when I came across that, and I started experiencing, for example, a certain subtle discomfort at getting too close, because my mom was pretty enveloping and then somewhat invasive. And there were times where it felt like she was a Trojan horse. She would lead with love, but as soon as I opened my gates wide and let her in, you know, the Greeks would boil out of the belly and start slaughtering everybody. So if you follow what I mean. So it's like, whoa, you know? But even more to the point, I kind of began, you know, to discover how there were these subtle inhibitions on expression, full expression of the authentic self, you know, being really completely revealed emotionally, for example, or vulnerably, or in real ways, or potency, you know, intensity, appropriate, let's say, power. Like, oh, there are inhibitions there on full autonomous self-expression. So both of these can be present in a person, and you can kind of mine this territory for what could be useful for you. Again, the point is mindfulness of experience. The Buddha offered a number of distinctions and ways for us to be mindful of our experience. I'm just trying to offer some now from a lot of material that's been very well developed, this object relations territory in psychology in the last 30, 40 years. Okay. Then last, besides these two particular and very common tendencies and patterns, I want to talk about our object relations altogether. And what I mean by that is, imagine, if you will, two circles, okay? Say self, object, self, other, okay? And I invite you to reflect on, to what extent are you preoccupied with others, including internalized others, or imagined others, or anticipated others, or feared others, preoccupied with them. In a way, that's problematic. I'm not speaking against appropriate, trying to figure out what got into your boss today. There's a place for that, or you know, what's upsetting someone or bothering someone, or how to navigate a fairly delicate situation, or who should we put next to who at Thanksgiving, you know? Like that, do we hide the wine before Uncle Bob leaves, you know, stuff like that. There's a place for that. But I'm talking about where it goes overboard and where this preoccupation with the object, in a funny kind of way, disempowers the, in a healthy sense, the person, the self altogether. So I'll give you an example of that. Like as a therapist, I'll talk with clients, and often I'll notice that the client keeps looping about a particular person. And it's not that they're telling me anything new or themselves anything new, or there's even a kind of exploration. It's just that they're preoccupied with that person. Now, for children, when you have a caregiver that's, you know, kind of wobbly as a attachment figure, it makes sense to be preoccupied. You should be preoccupied. You should be vigilant. You should track them. They should loom large in your sight when they're in the room, and loom large in your mind when you're falling asleep that night when you're 7 years old and trying to figure out what the heck, right? But today, that preoccupation with an object, an internalized object, can be a kind of bondage, a kind of unfreedom. You know, the Buddha used the metaphor of being entangled. It's a kind of entanglement with the internalized other, past the point that's useful. Or used another metaphor of a dog chained to a stake. You know, there's some freedom of movement, but you're very restricted by the stake that you're bound to. Right? Okay. So you kind of get that last one? And it's a fair question. To what extent are you too object referenced? And what should be more appropriate is, rather than a situation where self is small circle, object is big circle, which is kind of how it is for a lot of people, you know? And obviously we don't want to be in a situation where me, myself, and I, what them, you know? We don't want to be there, right? But to be in a situation where we have a kind of capacity to finish up here, in which we truly can enter into absolute intimacy as available and supported by the causes and conditions and appropriate, that's really there, while at the same time being, you know, completely free over here and unattached to our own experience. In other words, to be able to be profoundly we while also being able to be appropriately me in a way that's free and unattached in both senses. What do you think about all this? And how does it relate to you personally? It's a little abstract. You know, I wish I could have made it more down to earth. But I think if you look into this for yourself, you'll see a lot of this object relations stuff happening, often very quickly in the mind. Okay. So, questions, comments? Yeah, Tom.
It seems like one of the conditions of the relative position between self and others is, number one, past experience, and number two, the extent of fear that is built up because of those past situations.
Yeah.
And that, so the fear plays a very big part in it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And often there's a kind of, it's called a linking emotion between self and object. It could be fear, it could be anger, it could be a variety of things. And, you know, in the brain, it's described that there's this tension between speed and flexibility. You know, down in the brainstem are really, you know, the very, very simple animals with not a complex nervous system like a fruit fly or a mosquito, let's say, or even a lizard. Most of their behavior is very automatic and instinctual and very fast, right? Whereas as you engage circuitry that's further and further kind of up the so-called neural axis, and therefore more recent in time, it's a lot more flexible. We have a lot more response flexibility up here. But on the other hand, it's slower. So there's a kind of tension there and an imperfect collection of solutions. You see that tension between speed and yet inflexibility versus, you know, flexible thinking and being able to include lots of perspectives, but being slower and sometimes being, you know, caught by paralysis by analysis. Right? The same thing happens in terms of this objects, relations, territory. There's a place for, okay, you know, gender socialization. You know, okay, men are like that. It's kind of, it's like a code. Oh, women are like that. It's sort of a code. You know, transgender is, oh, that's interesting. I really got to wake up, you know, and not get so caught up in these familiar patterns. In the same way, internally, it's efficient to have representations of authority figures, oh, like that, right? Or groups of people are like that. On the other hand, we tend to get deluded and caught in simplistic views of reality altogether, including the opportunities that are available to us. So one thing to play with is to explore not knowing more and to watch the degree to which there are presumptions that arise. Oh, they're like that. Oh, they'll do this. Or their response will probably be that. And explore, do I actually really know that? Right? Or even, do I know, like, how to be? Like, automatically I'm supposed to be like this. Well, do I really have to be like that? Could I be freer in my relationship to my in-laws or my coworkers or my kids? One of the most useful things for parents to do with kids is to step out of familiar scripts, their own and the kids, and to create more opportunities for flexibility and not knowing, and revisions of their object relations. Okay. Yeah?
That brings into mind, I was reading a script the other day on dualism, and the Buddha says disempowerment is another form of gossip, per se. You know, we want to unify, that's empowerment, that's how our world evolves. Pretty much, basically, I forgot the saying, and that's part of my not remembering. When we know the universe is evolving is when, you know, social services, you know, there's no more prejudice, there's dualism, you know, we have an Afro-American president, blah, 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 these kind of sangre unities, that's evolving, you know, and hopefully we'll go more and more and more. And they were also saying that if you want to do that type of thing silently, like the Buddha was saying, you know, he was talking about afterlives and how we reincarnate and stuff. He says, but saying you have a father who had a very, very difficult time, instead of, you know, talking about it and, you know, when your father passes, give something of his away, and this, in lieu of this process you're doing, it will give him a better chance to come back in his afterlife to be nicer, to take away that suffering. It was lovely the way it was said. However, you know, it's part. part of being dualism and unified and thinking, what can I do to make this matter better? How can I create unity versus the opposite? You know, so it was really nice. And they were saying there are certain things you could do without, you know, being kind, without, you know, or leaving somebody something without saying you're doing it. But all this helps you and others. And that's, I just wanted to share that.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. You make me think about two examples. One is, like, for me, what was scary a lot when I was a kid were groups. One-to-one was okay. And I had this moment, I was in a meeting, and I realized that I was, my object relations, my presumed object, was this group, like this congealed, brick-like, unified blob of judgment, skepticism, and latent hostility toward me, right? Kind of like, that was like, oh yeah, welcome to junior high, you know, in a sense, right? That was my projection on them. That was my very efficient, you know, rapid, automatic presumption of what the case was. And then I stopped and I just started looking at the individuals. There are roughly a dozen people, and I knew each one of them, and I had this bizarre experience of group, like I said, judgmental, distancing, dismissive, and latently hostile. And then I look at each person. Oh, we're cool. I know you like me. We're cool too. Yeah. You know, and I just went through each individual and it was bizarre. Like each individual, I knew we were fine. They liked me and I realized that it was a delusion, this congealed presumption of the object, the group, you know, there, right? But I couldn't have seen that until I recognized that was the presumed other in the space. That would be one. A second is, for quite a while, it was scary for me to let really myself open and let other people in because it felt like it would just be too intense. That was my assumption. Oh, the other, the object will be invasive or overwhelming or too big, too much, can't handle it. That was my assumption. But then I began to realize or test that assumption, my presumed object, right? Is that actually true? And I began to realize that when I just really let people in, you know, that it wasn't overwhelming. That actually the real object, the real other, was different from my presumed object, my presumed other from growing up. Right? And also, last, that I could have more freedom myself, because part of this is about the self. What are you allowed to be? Who are you allowed to be? How much are you allowed to be? I see a number of people, they're usually women, not always, who basically talk about an internalized fear that they're too much for other people, because that was some of the message they got, or they saw it used to shame other women. So how big are you allowed to be? How free are you allowed to be? What are your presumptions about the self in the self-object paradigm or script that you're allowed to operate as? And can you break out of that script that's unfree as well? Yeah.
I had a question for you when you were talking about preoccupation, and is this happening to me before, and I'm curious if find this. I was preoccupied with a family member that I'm close to, my mom, and a behavior she was doing, and I was furious that I couldn't have her do a different behavior. And it hasn't happened for a while, and I was so sort of struck by how I could barely sit with myself. I was so angry. And I realized it was actually sadness that I couldn't, what I could do today wasn't going to change something that happened in childhood. And once I could be sad, I was totally unattached to changing a behavior now. Do you find that? I mean, it was such an odd switch to just tears and like no more anger and like, oh, just sadness of something that happened. I just didn't grieve.
Yeah, the way I would say that is I think often we form these patterns as a way to avoid painful experiences, including our preoccupation. Like, in a weird way, if we're preoccupied with this other person that we're entangled with, like a lover who betrayed us, it's a weird way to keep them close and avoid the painful experience of complete separation. Or what we fear, for example, would be a painful experience of complete separation. So that's another aspect of this as well, to look at, you know, how does the object, self-object pattern serve a function of keeping certain experiences at bay, which it sometimes does, and alternately, can you soften and allow those experiences to flow? And to be clear, there's a place for internalized others. We're deeply social animals, you know, to have an internalized sense of those who encourage us or love us, our pets, our friends, our family. I have a very internalized sense of both my parents very loving, much loving me, even as I, you know, do a little Woody Allen on them here in front of you all. So, yeah, that's important. So the art is, I think, to, moving to an end here, is the art, I think, is to be in the real world about the way the mind-brain system works and has evolved imperfectly to work. And to draw upon what, and to be skillful as we can with that in terms of internalizing healthy others, you know, healthy objects inside ourselves, right? And learning how to be sort of efficient and, you know, automatic to some extent in our dealings with others, because that's a way to conserve processing resources, et cetera, on the one hand. But on the other hand, boy, oh boy, oh boy, you know, like this little thing I described about myself, you know, this anticipated applause, right? Or the anticipated jeers and then working it. I've been on top of that for probably 20 years. I've seen it. I've recognized that it's, you know, kind of BS. It still tends to arise, right? And so there are subtleties here that are really worth tuning into and using this information as another kind of mindfulness instruction, another place to establish, or is the four foundations of mindfulness probably are better translated as the four establishments of mindfulness. Where do we establish our mindfulness? This is one more place where you can establish your mindfulness if that's helpful to you. And then more broadly, kind of my final thought on this, is that, at least for me, when I kind of look at this whole process, what a mess. it's okay. It's natural. It's human. It's living. Of course we have object relations. Of course we have self-other paradigms. We're social animals. Of course we're going to represent our experiences in various ways. And the brain is going to index across all kinds of specific details and find the fundamental common thread, the fundamental underlying script, even though the settings and the individuals have changed over time. That's just going to happen. And we're going to have certain experiences. And recognizing that, the kind of conditioned and somewhat arbitrarily arising nature of experience itself, including this object relation stuff, can take us into a greater disenchantment from experience altogether. In other words, by understanding these particular experiences having to do with self-other interactions that are internalized in the mind, by seeing these particular kinds of experiences more clearly, we can become more disenchanted with experience altogether. Not disgusted by it, not despairing about it, but waking up from the spell of it, and we get less and less attached to experience altogether, rather than just getting less attached to particular kinds of experiences. And that's a very, very powerful basis for freedom. So how about we sit with this for 1 minute and then we'll end officially. Thanks for your attention. May all beings be free. See you next week.